fulfilling. Sue Barrett has joined us semi-regularly now. We enjoy having a company. I have said before, and I'll say it again, I make no apology for the fact that we on this station will continue to push to support gender inequality, which we see on display, and we go all the way back to February, March, when Grace Tame was named Australian of the Year. She set the cat amongst the pigeons, and Brittany Higgins courageously followed. We haven't seen too much positiveness on the back of that yet, but we remain sort of optimistic. Sue Barrett, to help us work through that, good morning to you.
Good morning, Rob. Good morning to your listeners.
Good to have you back. Really appreciate your time. A little media release of yours some time ago had an interesting start. When your beliefs are entwined with your identity, changing your mind means changing your identity. What does that mean?
Yes, well, that statement actually is by Al Gore, so I can't lay claim to that.
I still like it, though.
I know, I like it too. The challenge we have a lot when people's, way they view themselves is tied up with whether it's their political identity, their identity in society, man or woman or transgender or whatever it is. A lot of us, say to people, oh, just change this, change that. But when it's tied up, when anything you're wanting to change is tied up with how you actually see yourself, that's the hardest thing to change. Because you're actually asking people to change certain beliefs, views, attitudes that they've formed over time, which have been probably reinforced and embedded by whatever practices and ideologies have been surrounding them. And so, when you ask people to stop being, awful to women, right, in terms of some of their behaviours, some of these people, they don't understand what you're actually saying, because they actually, it's this sort of conduct, this sort of abuse or this talking down to women or seeing them as something less than you is tied up in their current view or identity of themselves.
So on the back of some recent criticism from the government, we mentioned all the way back to Brittany Higgins, who with a conversation with the Prime Minister alerted him of some facts that he probably already knew, but it was on the public page, so it needed to be attended to, and the government stressed and promised that it would be dealt with. Julia Banks, a Liberal Party politician who wrote a book and opened up that wound again for the government, and again that the need to deal with it. So based on what you've said about deep-rooted feelings and philosophies, a one-hour non-compulsory program on sexual conduct may or may not make much difference.
I'm sorry, I have to laugh at this, because 1 hour training on any topic won't change anything, okay? So it doesn't matter what we're dealing with. Your listeners won't know, but I have a background in learning and development. And unfortunately, in the business world in particular, a lot of people have said, oh, we'll just do a, 1 hour, 1 day bit of training here and she'll be fixed. And it doesn't change anything. What you've got to do is make sure whatever you're wanting people to have a look at to develop or to evolve or change is that it actually is something, A, they can relate to, B, they actually see something positive coming out of making that change. I mean, why would you change if there wasn't anything positive coming out of it? And then you have to be able to work on that over time so the changes you're encouraging become second nature. So as adults particularly, if we're changing something, we're often having to let go of something we've done before and incorporating something new to override that programming, if you like.
Yeah.
So we're basically a bunch of memories and habits. And to actually make change, you have to be able to change all sorts of things from my identity, my meaning and purpose, my mindset, my attitudes, my knowledge, my skills, my behaviours, and then there's a whole host of things in there. So you can see why I'm laughing at this, tokenistic 1 hour non-compulsory training activity. I mean, what a waste of time, effort and money.
Yeah, and it will cost a lot of money, there is no doubt, and that's another extreme frustration for me, tokenism at best. But who do you think they're really pitching this sell at?
They're trying to show the public, oh, we're doing something. But if you don't understand how change happens and how learning happens, which most people don't understand at a conscious level, then most people think, oh, that'll do, but it doesn't. Like I said, 1 hour of training on any subject, doesn't matter what it is, won't change anything. What you've got to do is back it up with follow-up and follow-through and hold people to account to the change they say they're going to make. Or else you'll just have people rolling their eyes going, yeah, I've done the course, but not change anything. So they're trying to, it's really basically a PR stunt. It's not actually fundamentally shifting. If you use the 1 hour to raise awareness about the issue and then start to then put in place a follow-up process and a program that actually keeps this going, keeps it top of mind, helps people become aware of the impact, shows them what they're doing isn't helpful or is helpful, whichever way you're going, and bit by bit by bit by bit, like, you know, water dripping on a stone, over time you can eventually create that. But you've got to hold people to account to the change as well, or else those who, you know, are wedded back to their identity to misogyny and sexual abuse and, you know, mistreatment of women or whomever won't change.
You and I are having this conversation on the airwaves, and I don't know how many people are listening. Hopefully there's lots, and it'll open up their mind a little bit. But we spoke about this one other time about the role of the media, because I haven't really seen anyone in the media take anyone in the government to task over this, because all of the things that you've said, I would think that the majority of people that I know would agree with what you've said. They can see exactly what it is, what it's designed to do, yet they probably need to really be brought to task and questioned over this. Is that a frustration also of yours, that they've made this announcement and then that's it, there'll be no more?
Look, there's been a few press, you know, there's been a few articles written about this. There's definitely been a lot of commentary on Twitter and Facebook from, you know, people like, you know, myself and others who can see what this actually is tokenistic. I think the thing is that in the news cycle, you know, what's newsworthy? Will the general public actually really pay any attention to this or actually care about this? I do think we do, but the media have a duty to actually prosecute this and actually talk about why this isn't helpful, you know, this 1 hour of tokenistic training. But again, who's calling the shots at senior level, at the, you know, editorial level? What are their priorities? What are they trying to achieve? Are they actually helping the general public and the, you know, Australian community stay well informed with evidence-based journalism? Or are they actually focusing on other priorities like revenue, trying to keep the doors open? I mean, go back to senior leadership, and there's a great saying that we use in our work. It's an old German saying. You sweep the staircase from the top. And whether you're the Prime Minister or the head of a media organisation or any organisation for that matter, you're the one setting the agenda, you're the one setting the priorities, you're the one requesting your teams to actually, you know, prosecute a certain strategy. So my question would be, what are the media outlets, what are their strategies, what are they trying to prosecute, and is it in the best interest from an independent, evidence-based, journalistic perspective?
Because at this particular stage, right now, as we sit here, we have a unresolved rape allegation against a senior minister. We have an unresolved sexual harassment case against a senior minister. We have an unresolved alleged rape against a staffer, which involved senior ministers along the way tidying up the trail. They're all sitting there now, unresolved, at a time where this tokenistic response by the government has been announced. And I would have thought that would be something that the media outlets would be all over, because as you alluded to with your clever little German saying, there's a lot of people in our society now who will be emboldened by the fact that the very top end of town are behaving in a way which allows them to continue to think and act the way that they do.
Yes. Now, this is where I come back to when we actually had the March for Justice, as you know, I became, it's like a sliding door moment for me actually, became involved as part of the organising group for the March for Justice that saw, you know, over 110,000 people turn up to over 200 locations around the country on the 15th of March this year, 2021, to protest against, you know, the misogyny and workplace sexual abuse of women in Parliament House. And it was incredible. It was an amazing sort of rallying of people, not just women, but of men. Because as I've talked about earlier and many times since, this is a human issue. It's not just a women's issue. Now, when we come back and we have a look at that event, it raised awareness and it got people talking. Change takes time, but what I'm pleased to see as a result of Grace Tame, Brittany Higgins, and even though there are these issues that are unresolved that you mentioned, March for Justice, so on, the plight of women in Australia has not left the media landscape. It's remained there in many, many different forms. The program that's currently on the ABC, which is misrepresented, is a fantastic four-part series that looks at Parliament House Canberra and women in politics. And I encourage everyone to actually be able to go and watch it. I don't think a program like that could have been created without the groundswell of what actually happened with things like March for Justice. So change takes time, and the more we keep talking about this, like you and me today and others and programs like Misrepresented and those sorts of things, we'll keep the torch or the flame, you know, the flame on this topic, and eventually, we will find that these types of behaviours, these issues and these events that you mentioned, whether they will get prosecuted directly, but it will become standard operating procedure that this will become unacceptable and will be prosecuted. That's why I'm just going to keep going with this. We have to keep going. Unfortunately, a lot of people in this rather kind of instant gratification society, if you like, want change to happen now. But change is gradual and it happens over time. And so coming together and working on this over and over and over, like as I said, water dripping on a stone, we will create change. I grew up as a teenager in the 70s, right, at the height of the women's movement. And I was very conscious of that and very, you know, very much part of that, albeit as a teenager I probably wasn't at the forefront because, you know, I was at school and that, but I was so aware of it. And I've been on you know, this path of equality and respect and inclusivity and all of those things all my life, pretty much. And so, but what I was always worried about, particularly in the 90s and the 2000s, is that a lot of people said, oh, it's done now. You know, women's equality is fine. You know, everything's good. Don't have to worry about it anymore. But you can't. You can't let up on it because I don't know if you're aware of these statistics, but unfortunately, we've actually gone backwards at a great rate of knots in Australia. In 2021, our rankings in terms of women's equality and empowerment had fallen dramatically from 12th to 70th in economic participation and opportunity, from 57th to 99th in health and survival, and from 32nd to 54th in political empowerment since 2006, which is really terrible. So I was always anxious and worried that when we're not talking about women's equality, et cetera, it will go backwards, and these statistics prove that. So what's happened now is we've come together again with Grace Tame, Brittany Higgins, March for Justice and so on, Misrepresented and all of those things, and we have to keep at it and to have to keep moving forward to make sure that this doesn't go off the agenda. Sorry for that long dissertation. But
no, it's okay, and it's interesting because there's a couple of things against that. One is the simple way, and certainly people that cross my path, friends, acquaintances in life, will come up with this, that what you've just said and others around this, you're just bloody feminists causing trouble. Why don't you just get back in your box and shut up and let us get on with life as normal? That's still a very strong challenge to what you're doing. Do you think that's being broken down a little?
Well, this is why when we put the messaging together for March for Justice, I was really insistent that it had to be inclusive and it had to include men, not just women. Because I think people misunderstand what feminism is. It's not pro-women only. It's actually pro-human. It's actually about us working together and helping each other. It's not exclusionary, which is what those people you're talking about keep wanting to throw at us. They want to say, oh, no, it's either or. No, it's and. We're actually working together because we know when women, when their well-being, their health, their prosperity actually is in good stead, then everyone, the boat rises for everyone.
Mm.
Like men's lives will get better too. But when you've got people, this is back to your original question, it is back to their identity. Do you see how they fight you? Do you see how they tell you, no, 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 you bloody feminist, rah, 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 rah? That's rooted in their identity. And that's how they currently see the world, and which is why they treat it as a threat and fight back.
Yeah, their dominance is threatened by being dominated, and there's a fight back. Another interesting angle was, it wasn't all that long ago that two women had an interview on a particular evening television program, and one of the women who was a parliamentarian on the Julie Banks situation said, that's never happened to me in my time of parliament, so clearly it's not real. Julia Banks must be just a stooge for the Labor Party. That is clearly two women deliberately, knowingly undermining the cause as well. Is that also a concern for you, that even some women who are privileged in the male-dominated environment are not prepared to rock the boat?
Oh, absolutely. Back to the point, what are their vested interests? What are they trying to achieve here? What are they trying to prosecute? When that Brittany Higgins story, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but when that Brittany Higgins story broke on the 15th of February, I remember it very clearly, I lay awake all night that night thinking about all of the times and situations I myself and friends of mine and colleagues had to deal with sexual abuse and misogyny and sexism across our lives. I lay there, having been triggered by this, because I'll tell you, I'm happy to share this with people, there are at least seven incidents in my life where I've had to either talk or fight my way out of sexual abuse. Okay? The first one happened when I was 13, when I was nearly abducted in a car by a man. Now, he didn't know I was a swimmer and very strong, and I fought my way out of that and then ran away like hell. Now, you know, people who know me go, oh, my God, you have, I mean, you don't sound like you'd be someone who would actually be, you know, affected by that. Look how clear and articulate and strong and blah, blah, blah you are. You know, that's how often people see you. They don't understand that many of us have had experiences. You know, my first proper job in the pharmaceutical industry as a medical representative. I was 21, I was very young, and I got that job on my capabilities, so that was great. I remember going into a doctor's surgery, it was in Geelong, sadly, this is years ago, never met this man before, went in there, and he locked the door and then tried to give me a glass of whiskey at 11 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't matter what time of day it was, and then tried to actually molest me. But I jumped up and I told him to let me out, and he was being all... You can imagine how creepy and horrible the experience was. And I told him if he wouldn't let me out, I would hit him. You know, it's these sorts of things. Anyway, he eventually let me out. And that was a Wednesday, no mobile phone. You know, you kind of went, oh, my God, okay, handle that, whatever. There was no support, no one to talk to. And so when I went back to Melbourne and I met my boss, who was a lovely man in his 50s, I told him, I said, look, I've got to tell you something. This happened to me in this doctor's surgery. And this is what he said. Now, he didn't mean it in any negative way. He was a really caring man. But this is what he said to me. So, oh, don't worry, that's just him. So when I hear women like what you've just described saying, oh, that's never happened to me, well, great, I'm glad it's never happened to her, fantastic. But I can tell you there are thousands, if not millions of us, that it's happened to more than once on several occasions, and some of us have been able to survive and some of us haven't.
Yeah, that is quite extraordinary because, you know, I've fallen in the trap of thinking, well, here you are, a very strong, confident woman, but actually it was that strength and confidence that got you out of those predicaments as opposed to being vulnerable and falling into them. That's clearly empowered you over your life journey?
Well, I suppose when you think about when people are confronted with situations and that are frightening for them, okay, we go into survival mode, and there's three things we can do. We can either fight, flee, or freeze, okay? And what really drives me insane is when, you know, we hear stories about women, for example, or young women or girls. Why didn't they just scream? You know, why didn't they just leave? Or why did they just be quiet? Well, because they chose the freeze response because the worst response was being killed.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, people don't understand what actually happens to people, men and women, boys and girls, right? They don't understand what happens, and they make these judgments and they have these views of the world that are very, very narrow and actually unhelpful. And so you see some of these people, they freeze because the worst scenario is to be murdered. So they just cop it and hope it'll go away, stay very still and survive somehow. I have learned to, you know, either talk my way out of things or, as I said, in some situations, because I'm very physically strong from all the sport and things I've done in my life, I fought my way out of things. I didn't want to have to do that at all. There are situations where I've probably come across too, and I think about it, where someone said something and it's too dangerous to say something. So I've frozen as well. So we can't make, you know, binary judgments about people. And I have to say, for me personally, those experiences of my life still bring up lots of feelings and emotions and anxiety, and I just want to have a big cry. And I want to be able to hold hands with other people. The amount of women that I met through the March for Justice thing who are so, you know, torn and broken by what's happened to them, right, just shows you what a awful systemic, endemic issue all of this is in our country. And we need to stop it.
Sue, in all discussions where you're being critical of what's happening, the secret to come out of it with is to have an alternative, to say, well, look, that doesn't work, we should be doing this. I'm really excited by your comment about women don't have the rights to feminism. Men can be feminists as well to help make that change. Are you confident that, you mentioned the wheels are turning slowly, but are they turning in the right direction?
I think so, and I think the more we talk about these things and the more we actually come back to what we share in common and we find common ground with each other, and so put gender to one side, what do we want as humans? So one of the things I think we can do is start having conversations about, you know, what do we all care about? What's important to us? And, you know, for many of us, you know, it's family and having, you know, good work, being able to have a community environment that we can feel safe in and those sorts of things. And, you know, and help people understand that my version of safety may be very different from a man's version of safety, right? So, you know, when you walk in the street or I walk in the street, we have different things we're thinking about because our experiences of women, you know, as women, you know, we have to think about several other things to make sure we're safe. So I think if we can find common ground together and actually start talking about what does a really good society look like, how can we improve it, you know, how can we help people feel safe and feel valued and feel supported, regardless of gender. I think that's a really great place to start. And you'll find that we have so many things in common. This is where what I don't want is, regardless of what side of politics you're on or, you know, what football team you follow or, you know, whatever it is that you have wedded your identity to, don't forget that we share a lot more in common than we have in difference because we're human. And we need shelter. We need work, we need food, we need, you know, creativity. We need all sorts of things that actually enrich our lives and help us feel safe and supported. So that's one of the things we can start to do. I think that what's really important is that the highest office in the land needs to get with the times and actually has to have several things put in place. And one is to be able to be held accountable to the Sex Discrimination Act of 1984, which the rest of us in this country in business are held to account to. So that would be a good start. Second is to actually have a proper human resources department where actually these things are actually, there's a safe place for people to go to actually address anything that happens from a workplace safety perspective, have standards in place. I think they should remove free alcohol from Parliament House. People may not be aware, but there's free alcohol available 24/7 pretty much in Parliament House, Canberra. I think they should remove that there, and that, and people should be actually, drug and breath tested if they're going to work, just like on other workplaces. So I think Parliament House, Canberra needs to get with the times and have proper workplace safety and health conditions put in place there. And then also too, we need a federal ICAC. We need an actual integrity commission, because where there's abuse, there's corruption. Okay, so we need to have it constitutionally implemented that we need those things in place so that it's not a free-for-all and anyone can do whatever they like. There are boundaries and guidelines and references that allow us to be able to hold people to account for standards of their decision-making, standards of their behaviour, just as we would expect in any other viable, ethical workplace environment. So there's some of the things that we could start to look at and help people, have better outcomes from these experiences.
The ICAC is something that's been talked about now for 10 years. It was spoken about in the previous Gillard-Rudd government period, and it was a pledge when this current government came into power, which is over 8 years ago now. There's been tokenism given to it. There was a draft made up which was not accepted by one side of politics, is because it effectively meant that no individual could be challenged, if you like. So it was just completely inept and toothless. When the government are policing themselves on these matters, how do we, the general public, force their hand more?
Yes, well, good luck with getting any accountability when it's self-policed. Okay, so that's why it needs to be independent and very, very clear about what's acceptable and what's not. Because when we have standards of behaviour and conduct and ethics and those sorts of guidelines in place, then it's easier for us as the citizens of Australia to actually assess the competence, capability, ethics and integrity of the people that are representing us. So we need to make that very clear and visible. So whether you look at it or not, it should be there, and it should be able to, people should be able to be held accountable to that. So this is when we actually get to people thinking about representative democracy and making sure that they're aware of what and who they're electing. So would you accept that standard of behaviour or that conduct in any other part of your life? You know, if the answer is no, then rethink who you're voting for. You know, check their purpose and credibility, you know, our politicians. Or it's not just politicians, think business, think businesses you're dealing with, think, community groups that you belong to, anyone. So what do they stand for? What are their morals, their values, their ethics, their focus, their principles, their ideas, their ideologies, their areas of interest? You know, what are they trying to achieve? Is it for the common good or only for a few? You know, what do they represent, both overtly, as invisible to us, but covertly? I think it's really important to check who's funding them, who are the vested interests, what is their long game that they're playing. The other thing you can check for as well is, do they focus on what we call triple bottom line outcomes? That is, you know, is, if it's an organisation, profitable, but is it human or people-centred, and is it actually good for the environment, for the planet? And this is where we're seeing a lot of businesses, for example, becoming what we call business-worthy or pro-social. They recognise that if their employees, their customers, their communities are actually made vulnerable and can't, you know, have the things that make for good society, then their businesses are vulnerable as well. So we are seeing a real shift away from what I would call pro-selfish business, and we could also call some of these political parties pro-selfish, to much more pro-social. Now, the two-party preferred system from a political perspective, you know, you have to assess them and see where they stand. But also too, this is why we're seeing a rise in independence, where we've got individuals who are representing individual electorates who are coming in with more of these things that I'm talking about to represent their communities across these different areas and not be held hostage or, you know, by these vested interests who are looking to strip mine, you know, our country for whatever reason or purpose.
Yeah, we talked earlier today about that. I think the rise of good independents and hopefully the passion and desire for them to get in and make a difference. I think that they've been happy to sit back, but hopefully the social change that we're seeing will drive some more good people, that like the Zali Steggles and Andrew Wilkies of the world, who have gone in and doing some really, really good work and really making people accountable for their actions. And I hope that more people in our community are prepared to stand up and do that. What about yourself, Sue? Do you see a politician in you?
I've been asked that question on more than one occasion, Rob, and I think I'm actually better working on the sides and looking at the system and being able to actually affect change there and then supporting what I would call really, you know, good conduct, honourable conduct and those sorts of things. Look, I can't say absolutely, you know, a no to it, but I at this point in time, I can't see a future for me in that space directly, but I do would like to help, you know, others who are looking at whether they're running as an independent or help to affect change, you know, across that broader, you know, democratic process, broader societal process, you know, really looking at how we operate, you know, good businesses, good communities, good families, you know, good society, those sorts of things. So I don't know yet, but it's not on the cards at the moment.
Excellent. We thank you so much for your time this morning. Look forward to another chat in a little while from now, but we will not let this go. And I think I've got a privileged position here, and I'm going to keep pursuing this until such time as we get noticeable change. And I haven't seen any yet, and it still makes me quite ill to see we're so many days beyond that February 15 time, and there's no clear lines in the sand been drawn yet.
Okay, change is incremental, bit by bit, it happens. So just keep, when we look back in a year's time, in 2 years' time, we keep the pressure up, we will start to see very more visible change. So that takes all of us as people to actually act on this and not default the responsibility to others. It's up to each of us. Each of us doing little acts that may not be perfect, but little acts every day of kindness and goodwill and support for each other makes fundamental change happen over time.
Good advice to finish. Thank you, Sue Barrett. We look forward to our next conversation with you.
My pleasure, Rob. Take care, everyone.